We present a program by Henry Reed. Not a Drum Was Heard, the War Memoirs of General Gland. Now here is Bill Lovell to introduce tonight's program.
The memoirs of General Arthur Gland are not yet, of course, in any very definitive form. But a few months ago, three of us from BBC Features Sound Interrogation Unit, myself, George Hicks, and Margaret Moss, went down to stay with the General, and we are now able to give listeners an interim report. It was a most beautiful day in spring, and we all three, myself, George Hicks, and Margaret Moss, felt it was a great privilege to be allowed to go down and visit the General in his charming country home near Mulchester, which, with the gentle Mulcet Downs spreading placidly all round, seemed to make such a perfect spot for a town. Well, General Gland, it is the most beautiful day in spring.
Sir?
And we all three, myself, George Hicks and Margaret Moss, feel it's a great privilege to be allowed to come down and visit you in your charming country home near Mulchester.
It belongs to my twin sister Alice, in point of fact, but naturally she's asleep at the moment.
Which, with the gentle Mulcet Downs spreading placidly all round, seems to make such a perfect spot for retirement.
She may wake up a bit later on, of course, but she can never be quite sure at this time of year.
Yes. We do feel, all of us, that we're helping to contribute to the pages of recorded sound history, a document that has long been needed to fill a gap, and that the future will thank us for our efforts.
Sorry? Oh, yes, yes, well, let's hope it will. I can't say it's ever thanked me, but it's dreadfully decent of you fellows and Miss Moss to come down here. Miss Moss is the one in the skirt, I suppose.
Yes. Interestingly enough, this is the first time a woman reporter has taken part in research of this particular kind.
Yes, well, we have to move with the times. It's a thing we all have to reconcile ourselves to sooner or later, I suppose. Still, a truce to idle compliments. Let's get straight down to the plan of campaign. You'll have had the few notes I've knocked together and sent you.
Yes, indeed.
A few things I think have long needed saying about the conduct of the late Watsit, and I have no doubt we'll be able to whack the rest out between us. Is Miss Mogg quite comfortable?
Moss.
Say?
Miss Moss's name is Miss Moss.
Well, I don't question that, but is she quite comfortable? That's what I asked.
I'm very comfortable, thank you, General Gland.
Oh, really? Well, yes. Well, I must warn you all right from the start that no British general ever likes to boast of his achievements. And you will not, I venture to think, catch me boasting of mine.
Oh, no, General Gland, of course not.
I've tried, of course, to get other people to do it for me. But you know, it's amazing how you find, as the evening of life begins to draw in, how dreadfully ungrateful and ungenerous people can be.
Oh, well, are you thinking of anyone in particular, General?
Yes, I am. Thinking of my brother-in-law, Stephen Schoen. He's married to my sister Connie, the dotty one, you know.
Uh-oh.
Now, there's always been a great affection between Stephen and me, and the family was very grateful to him for taking old Connie on like that. Of course, our lives have followed different paths.
Indeed.
I've always myself led a strenuously active life, as you know. And Stephen has always led what could be called a sedentary life, if only he'd ever got as far as actually sitting up. So I approached him.
And what was the upshot, General Glenn?
Steve, old thing. Well, well.
Good morning, Arthur.
Steve, old lad, it is nice to see you again. Where have you been all these weeks?
Months, Arthur, months.
Well, yes, dammit, I suppose it must be by now. Where have you been all this time?
Here, Arthur, here. As you could have discovered had you cared to call, write, telephone, or employ the aid of a private detective agency.
Yes, yes, time does pass, dammit. And you've got a new bedside bell. Can I try it?
I can deny you nothing, Arthur.
Thanks, old lad. Very pretty. Oh, I like that. Tinkle, tinkle.
You want something, Arthur.
Say?
What is it that has made you suddenly overcome your deep natural aversion from Connie and myself so far as to set foot in our house?
Oh, no, there was nothing of that. Steve, good God, man, don't think that.
Oh?
But you know, Steve, I wanted to ask your advice.
Ah.
You see, Stephen, you've known me a long time.
Yes.
And we were both so devoted to dear old Dick, bless him.
Yes?
Dear brother Dick, as you used to call him.
No.
And it's frequently borne in on me that it's about time my war memoirs were released on the world. It's had most of the others released on it.
Yes.
So what I thought was you might enjoy giving me a hand in letting mine out, so to speak.
Oh.
Say?
No, Arthur. I should feel I was usurping dead men's shoes.
But I'm still alive. You can have them later on, of course, though I always thought you took a size larger.
No, dear Arthur, no. All I wished to remark was that dear brother Dick, as you call him, has already immortalized you in the character of Colonel Thyroid in his novel of The Bang and the Whimper. What more could posterity ask?
But... Oh, well, Stephen, yes. But after all, that was only me as a young chap, and, oh, dreadfully idealized, you know, dreadfully idealized. Dear old Dick.
But, Arthur, dear, should posterity think of the picture of Colonel Thyroid as too idealized a portrait, it can always redress the balance by reference to dear brother Dick's later romance, The Back and the Front.
Stephen.
Wherein you appear as William Acorn, the keeper of an equivocal tea house in Tokyo, Japan.
Damn it, Stephen, you know as well as I do that Dick always swore everyone in that book was a blood relation of his.
Dear brother Dick. Dear brother Dick. Dear brother Dick.
Well, that's the way it is these days. Ingratitude. Lack of generosity.
I fear it's a common experience, General.
You go and ask some for help, and they try to take the very boots off your feet. And while we're on the subject, do you know a chap the name of Herbert Reeve?
No, I can't say I do.
I think I know who you mean, General Gland. He's a scholar and critical writer, isn't he?
Are you still quite comfortable, Miss Marsh?
Yes, thank you.
Yes. And, well, this chap Herbert Reeve is engaged to my niece, Janet, and God help this country of ours if it's to be peopled by some people I could name. I made some sort of hesitant approach to him also a few days ago.
And what were his reactions, General?
Pretty bell you've got here, Reeve.
Good morning, sir.
Nice. Reeve, I've come to ask you something.
Oh, yes, sir?
It's this. Do you believe in ghosts?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I've never seen one.
The chaps are saying I ought to have one.
You, General?
Yes.
The General, I think that ghosts are usually only associated with the idea of persons who have, already died, as it were.
Oh. Damn it, man, I'm not talking about specters.
Oh?
No, I meant those chaps that chaps get. Like old General Winbrook, for instance.
Huh?
Have you read his four books about himself? Spiffing stuff. Volume 1, Dreams of Glory. Volume 2, Onset of Glory. Volume 3, The Thick of Glory. And Volume 4, Respite from Glory. Say?
No, I... Can't say I've actually read them yet.
Splendidly bound, they are.
Yes?
So is he, of course, a lot of the time. And he told me all those books were done by a ghost.
Oh, I see. You mean they were done by a ghost. They were ghosted, as they say.
Yes, by one of those chaps get. So that's what I think I'll get you to do.
No.
I can provide you with masses of material. Be no trouble for an experienced chap like yourself.
No, General Gland.
None whatever.
I meant no, General Gland.
Good. Then we might have a preliminary rough mull over old times this evening, say?
No.
What I'd like you to do is draw me out gradually.
No.
Don't keep saying no, old boy. It's monotonous almost. Naturally, I shan't boast, or if I do, it'll be only very reluctantly, as of course you'll be perfectly free to point out from time to time.
General Gland.
Say?
General Gland, I'm very sorry, but the nature and extent of the work I have planned out for the next few years will entirely preclude any new project, even were it one I felt I could do justice to.
Oh, I can cope with the justice part myself.
No, General, I think you misunderstood me. I have to say, very reluctantly, but quite conclusively, that I cannot undertake to write or even to ghost anyone's memoirs. It is a thing I have no intention of doing.
Yes, man, but all I'm asking is, when are we going to start?
Never.
You mean you won't?
Yes, General. I mean I will not.
Well, I'm sorry I asked. Very sorry indeed. I thought the thought of helping my niece's poor old uncle would please you. Didn't expect it to be greeted by a torrent of unbridled ferocity and abuse. I hate abuse. I'm very disappointed in you, Reeve. Your character's deteriorating. And look at your left shoe. Oh, lace it up, man, for God's sake. What sort of future?
General Gland?
All face. Say?
General Gland, stop belly aching.
Say?
Stop belly aching, General.
All right. But lace it up, man. Lace it up, surely I can ask of.
It is not undone, General.
Well, that's how it is. A spirit of contradiction prevailing everywhere. It's a thing a man of my age has to get used to. It's the way the young show their gratitude.
Oh, I'm sure everyone is highly appreciative of all your achievements, General Gland.
You're still quite comfortable, Miss Mott?
Yes, thank you.
Well, you know what it is, don't you? Appreciative? Oh, I wonder. Still, we have to face it. There's very little left for a general to do once he's too old for harness. I've looked round, of course. I'm very active, and I once hoped that I might be allowed to control the BBC.
Indeed.
It needs control quite clearly. And it seemed to me I was the obvious person to control it. After all, I have the qualification. But it was not to be. My relations with the BBC have never quite gelled in the way I could have wished. No matter. Truce to idle thinking. Let's get to the root of the matter.
We thought we might start with some reminiscences, General, of your early experiences.
Quite, oh, quite right.
Well, sir, perhaps you'll tell us about your early days.
I remember very little of the first 37 years of my life. Must have got through them somehow, I suppose, at some time or other. I regard them as the formative years of my life. They formed me. They made me what I was, and the years between then and now have made me what I am. Let's press on.
But excuse me, General, surely you must remember something of your early life.
No, don't think so. Well, of course, I remember being born, naturally.
What?
There was an article in the British Medical Journal about it. I looked it up years later.
Was there something unusual about your birth, General?
Is Miss Mugg still quite deep?
Yes, thank you, General, and I'm most interested in what you're seeing.
Well, the interesting thing was that my twin sister Alice and myself were born at exactly the same moment. There's always been a certain fairly friendly sibling rivalry, as my dear niece Janet would call it, between us. And it's been part of the strength of the characters of both of us that neither of us has ever yielded an inch to the other. Nor did we on this occasion. Dreadfully uncomfortable for my poor dear mother at the time, of course. But I'm glad to say she survived and gave birth to my other sister, Connie, some 7 or 8 years later.
Yes.
Connie is the dotty one, of course.
Oh.
And Alice is just a bit sleepy.
And that's all you can recall of your early life?
More or less. Can't say I remember my christening, though it must have taken a hell of a time.
How's that, sir?
Well, have you seen my name in Who's Who?
I have.
Someone speak.
Yes, I did, General. Your name is given in Who's Who as Arthur Dowd Hyacinth Dowd Wilbraham Cork Gland.
You make it sound far more beautiful than it really is, Miss Mosley.
Oh, thank you.
Say it again.
Arthur Dowd Hyacinth Dowd Wilbraham Cork Gland.
Yes. Splendid. The name's full of interesting touches. The Arthur was after my grandfather, who opposed the repeal of the Corn Laws in whenever it was. Dowd after my uncle. Hyacinth, after somebody called Robinson in the book by Henry James and my mother once tried to read. Dowd, after me uncle again. He just made a great fortune up in the Klondike. Wilbraham to introduce a touch of variety. Cork, after that place in Ireland where my parents first met. And Gland... Gland. Oh, yes, that'd be after my father.
Yes,
that'd be it.
And you recall nothing further about your childhood?
Well, I wouldn't say nothing, you know. I remember vividly the time my cousin James Dowd Gland taught me how to... I got it. But it's no moment. It had no bearing.
And your school days?
Well, of course, I went to school. I went to... what was the name of the place? Harrow. Says so somewhere. But it's no good grubbing up old sores, is it? And it had no bearing.
And early manhood?
Yes, I had one of those, too.
Do you remember much about it?
Made me what I am. Or was, rather.
What was it that made your 37th year so memorable?
Well, I wouldn't call it exactly memorable, you know. Though I do remember it, in fact.
Why?
Say?
Why?
Well, I was 37 at the end of it. That's all, I think.
Yes.
It had very little bearing.
No.
I think we ought to press on. If Miss Mott is still quite comfortable.
You were, of course, already in the army at the age of 37, General.
Oh, yes, I must have been.
How did you come to notice that fact, General Bland?
Oh, you tumble to it after a time, my dear. You twig it, my dear.
And, of course, it is chiefly your military career we're anxious to know about, General.
Oh, naturally.
General Gland?
Yes?
General, how did you manage to get into the army in the first place?
Sir?
I think what Miss Moss means is, what made you choose the army as a career? Isn't that it, Maggie?
Yes, that's roughly it.
Well, tell her to... well, of course, the army was a career in those days, you see. It was a career, by golly. Let's press on.
Well, sir, we would like to include some account of your time at Sandhurst.
Sandhurst, yes. Well, regretfully, though, I have to say it. My experiences at Sandhurst must still be regarded as a story for which the world is not yet prepared.
I see.
Like the giant rhinoceros of Sumatra, you know.
Yes. The what, sir?
The giant rhinoceros of Sumatra.
The giant rat, General.
Say?
It was a giant rat.
What was?
The rhinoceros. The reference, I mean.
What reference?
To Sherlock Holmes. That was it, surely.
My sister Alice may be down at any moment, Miss Molesworth. She'll see to you. Have no fear. Shall we press on?
Well, sir, as I explained in my letters, we were hoping to make quite a big thing of your experiences in the First World War.
Yeah.
Since your part in that conflict has, as it were, become part of our national history. Now, I'd like, if I may, to be allowed to let George Hicks here question you about that. Hicks is a student of the military history of those days.
Is he really? Splendid.
You ready, George?
Yes. Well, General, there are a number of things I'd like to discuss in some detail about the First World War.
Well, press on, man. Forward your head.
Well, sir, what was your first reaction to being under fire?
Fire? Oh, I'd got used to that at Sandhurst long before. Even at Harrow, in a sense.
But what was it like to be on the field of battle and, for the first time, a shot fired in anger?
Oh, I don't think there was anything of that, you know. I don't think anyone was angry.
Still, this was a major war, General, between major powers.
Yes, but I think I'd have noticed if anyone had been angry. I think you can rule that out. We left that sort of thing to the politician.
I...
press on, man.
Well, General, as you know, there has been much comment about the part you played in the winter campaign of 1917. I wonder if you still think you were right in your course of action at Brétigny.
Tell me, Mr. Hicks, do you always say, ha-ha, after the first word in every sentence you have occasion to utter?
Well,
and again at the conclusion of the pronouncement?
Well, I'm sure I hope I don't.
No, well, we can always hope, can't we?
Yes. Yes.
It's always open to any of us to hope.
Yes.
Ha ha!
Well, General, do you still think you were right in your particular decision about Ho Tien-Yi?
It's what is known as a speech tick. Have you never noticed it yourself?
Well, no, I can't say I have.
Its origins often go right into the depths of the personality, revealing the most dreadful buried conflicts over the use of the potty in early infancy. You've never tried having it psychoanalyzed?
No.
That might help. Sir?
Nothing.
Ah, well now. Is there any question you wanted to ask about the First World War, for example?
General Gland, do you still think you were right about the conduct of the engagement at Ho Tien-Yi in the winter of 1917?
Well, ha-ha. That's not the kind of question one usually expects from a lady. Ha-ha.
Oh, come, General. I'm sure you're indifferent to matters of sex in investigations of this nature.
Well, ha-ha. I can't think how that idea's got about. Ha-ha.
And one of the questions still asked is, what is your present attitude to the incidents at Ho Tien-Yi and Hill 501?
Is it? Ha-ha. Is it really? Ha-ha.
But surely, ha-ha, General Gland, ha-ha, it is a question frequently debated, ha-ha, in the, ha-ha, in the...
Ha-ha?
Ha-ha.
Ha-ha. Ha-ha. Listen, ha-ha, to those lovely bells. Aren't they beautiful?
General Gland, in many of the memoirs written by men who served in the First World War, there are numerous, somewhat critical and even at times scathing references to the career of a character whom, interestingly enough, though they none of them mention him by name, they all concur in referring to as Major G. Now, General, you yourself were a major through most of the First War. And it has been sometimes suggested that you yourself might be Major G.
No. Oh, no. No, no, no. My solicitors have frequently gone into that matter. They were quite convinced that no reference to me was intended at any point. Quite convinced.
I see, sir.
In fact, I convinced them myself.
Have you any idea who Major G might have been in that case, sir?
No. Oh, no. No, no. No. He was some poor plum-headed blighter, I suppose, and whoever the poor devil was, the chaps who wrote about him weren't much to write home about themselves, by golly. Press on.
Ah. Well, prominent among the authors who mention Major G is General Sir Hugh Parkinson Warlock, the author of They Did Not Pass. What is your opinion of him?
Lamentable.
Oh, but sir...
Lamentable. Grave mistake. Major error.
But short...
Yes, by golly. There was a lot of head shaking at old Parkinson Warlock's funeral. At Woking, it was. We all turned up for it, of course. After all, he'd been a delightful fellow, personally. I think I can speak for my brother officers when I say that we buried him with a countenance more in sorrow than in anger. Ours, I mean, of course, not his. His had already been cremated with the rest of his person earlier the same day.
But General Grant...
Say?
General Sir Hugh Parkinson Warlock is still alive.
Is he really? Oh, that is good news. I must look him up. Have the greatest respect for him. What a thing friendship is. World without end, as Tennyson so beautifully has it.
Browning, General.
I thought you were comfortable, Miss...
And next there is General Sir Roger Mayhap Weatherby, the author of I Have Not Winced.
Well, you seem to have made another damn great cut out of what I've put about him.
But I think you'll find it joins up quite logically.
Does it? Well, let's have a look then. The thing, alas, that had to be faced about Roger Mayhap Weatherby was the rather morbid friendliness he always developed towards his... friends. Well, that doesn't leave much in about old Mayhap Weatherby, does it? I thought they didn't mind nowadays. Well, let's press on.
Finally, we'd like some impression of Major General Sir Graham Stitch,
whose autobiography, Some Cromwell Guiltless, has also a number of passages about Major G.
I've dealt with him in this bit here, do you say, beginning, his head was pure ivory from ear to ear.
No, sir. No, I'm sorry, we can't.
Well, you mean that's out too? Oh, dearie me, I am sorry. Well, I can't think why he wanted to cut that out a good bit, I thought.
Eventually, we did persuade General Glenn to give us his own unvarnished account of the incident so often associated with his name in the military records of the winter of 1917.
Great days they were. Great days. Great days of planning and daring do and strategy. Tactics even at times.
As General Glenn dwelt upon the tense waiting period of those dark days, the peaceful cretonne and leather of the Malsit sitting room seemed to fade. And we saw, as it were, before our eyes, the dugout, and four men in the candlelight, waiting. Four officers loyally waiting for orders from above. Waiting. Waiting to make history. Hugh Parkinson Warlock, Roger Mayhap Weatherby, Graham Stitch, and Arthur Glenn.
For God's sake, and I mean for God's sake, I'm tired of it.
Well, here it is. Here's the map. There's Utini. There's Hill 501. The question is, are they going to order us to make a try at a deep pencil-like thrust from there to there? Or will they make it a series of sharp knife-like jabs here, here, and here, followed by a pincer-like squeeze round the base of Hill 501?
Which will cut us off not only from reality, but also from Uplagur.
You would say that.
Well, of course I say it. If I had the ordering of it, we should begin with a preliminary prong-like probe in the direction of Pipla Vero.
Not if the war's going to be over by Christmas.
I thought it didn't have to be over till Easter.
Oh, don't let's all be bloody silly, and I mean all, for God's sake. I'm tired of it.
Well, why should I know anything about it? Why should I? Go on, wash out my suggestion of a preliminary prong-like probe. Ignore it. Go on.
Look here, Hugh. If this were a preliminary action, I'd agree with you right up to the hilt, you know I would. But it's not. It's a pre-preliminary action, if that's clear. What we have to do is, A, get a watertight jumping off board to kick off from, B, deliver a sharp left hook to the Boche's right, and C, make him fetch his top trumps out.
All you'll be doing is jumping your fence.
Rot. Absolute rot.
You'll be jumping your bloody fences and jumping them on a damn sticky wicket, what's more. What do you say, Glenn?
I think you're making too much of it. What's to prevent us from suddenly pouring down in a wide, fan-like advance from the top of Hill 501?
Only the fact that for the last 5 months, Hill 501 has been held by the Boche, that's all.
By golly, has it now? Well, I'd never been told that.
Well, you've been told now.
I should think they must be using our lines of communications as skipping ropes.
If you'd ever looked to the bloody hill, you could have seen for yourself.
I don't like to be spoken to like that, Roger.
Oh, for God's sake, then let's all be bloody silly. And I mean bloody silly, all of us. I'm tired of it.
Well, I've always believed in the wide, fan-like advance.
Which has usually turned out to be indistinguishable from a cone-like retreat. Now, the preliminary prong-like probe...
Oh, God, what with you and your preliminary prong-like probes, the war will go on to August bank holiday.
You've missed out, Whitson.
Oh, don't let's all be bloody silly, and I mean, Dan, for God's sake. I'm tired of it.
Well, there you have it. It's what I've always maintained. There comes a time when an enterprising young officer has to cut through the red tape and the probe-like prongs and the rest of the antediluvian crepe and make his own decision. It was one of the many occasions when I made mine. Now, the position was clear. I had my eye on the ball, which in this case was Hill 501, a large breast-like eminence between us and Old Tiki. I had long suspected that this hill was occupied by the Boche, and I was quite right. They had fanned out and up some months before from Altini on a 700-yard front. I saw quite clearly what had to be done, and I did it. It was against orders, and there are many people to this day who maintain that I didn't understand what the orders were. I did understand them, and I thought they were wrong. 2 hours before zero, I ordered my chaps to make a sudden lurch-like lurch upwards, and everything went according to plan. My plan, I need hardly say. About halfway up the hill, we got stuck. This was exactly as planned. I call it the end of phase one. There was considerable loss of life, and it was some days before we got through news of where we were. Warlock and Mayhap Weatherby sent a detachment after us to try to get us back, but I decided that up and on, not down and back, was the order of the day, and on and up we got, somewhat impeded for a fortnight or so by violent snowstorms, rather unusual for the time of the year. I called this end of phase two. By this time, either in a mistaken impression that we were in a hopeless position and must be abandoned, or that we could manage quite well by ourselves, in which, as it happens, they were quite right, Warlock and Mayhap decided on a tactical retreat in all sectors away from Hill 501. Nothing daunted, we pressed on and up. That was phase three. As is well known, the struggle lasted some 35 days from the end of November 1917 till the beginning of January 1918, Christmas being celebrated in the usual way on December the 25th. At the start of the engagement, Hill 501 was in German hands, together with a 700-yard strip towards Eltini. By the end of it, the enemy had been forced to spread his strength in depth completely around the entire base of Hill 501, which was, as I had planned, now completely occupied by us. Our main forces, still under the command of Mayhap and Warlock, such is trust, were dug in some 15 miles to the southwest. It has sometimes been suggested that we were isolated, though that is only true in the sense that everyone else had completely lost contact with us. We were isolated, but we were also victorious. It had taken 35 days, but it had been worth it. Hill 501 was ours. I remember the simple words in which I addressed the men. I said, "This hill is ours." And I remember them, one of them calling out in that honest, homely way that I always so much like in the British soldier. "You're right, Cocky," said, "it bloody is." One forgives familiarity at such a moment, one has to.
The Germans did, in fact, recapture the hill, didn't they?
Oh, yes, the next day. But the hill is still there. And my point, you see, is this. The classic strategy of war is not unchanging. Not unchanging.
Well, so much for the war of 1914 to 1918. Have you any general remarks to make about it, General?
It was, I think, a good war. One of the best there have been so far. I've often advanced the view that it was a war deserving a far better generalship than it received on either side. Not that our enemies were to be sneezed at. I remember old Dieter von Kürkelsdorf, for example, a Russian general I'd known in peacetime. He had a splendid set of steel teeth, the envy of everyone. However, a war, thank God, has a capacity for surviving the mere ebb and flow of generals. And like most wars, the war of 1914-18 did in fact go on for quite a long time after it had stopped.
You refer, no doubt, General Glenn, to the campaign in the north of Russia after 1918, in which you yourself played no small part.
Well, yes, yes. It cannot be gainsaid.
You had the interesting experience of being captured by the Russians, I believe, sir.
It didn't, ha-ha, seem very funny at the time, I assure you, ha-ha.
Well, of course I...
quite so, quite so. Yes, I was captured by the Ruskers. In the Denikin show, of course.
How exactly did that happen, sir?
Well, it was, as you might say, a mixture of enterprise and miscalculation on my part. One can't always get things right. Anyway, the facts are these. Even in the midst of the stern realities of war, I am sometimes seized with an insatiable craving for the things of the spirit. I'm sorry, but there it is. And by golly, we hadn't been prowling about Mother Russia long before I felt I really must try and see the Bolshoi Ballet or bust. My idea was to get behind the lines, nip in at the back of the stalls after everyone had gone in, see it, nip out, and nip back again. Well, ha-ha, it's an absurd thing to confess, ha-ha, Mr. Hicks, but I didn't realize how far Archangel is from Moscow if you're completely without transport. So, of course, I got caught. Simple as that. I have to say that the Ruskies behaved with the greatest courtesy, and so did I. Indeed, I think I can claim to have played my own small part in cementing the firm and friendly relations that have prevailed between Russia and ourselves for the last 40 years.
Yes.
Of course, it helped things, my being able to talk with them in their own language. They appreciated it. It soothed them, you might say.
Das schließlich kommt der Kopf bei der britanischen Position. Wir dürfen nicht die Hatschina weihen, die Plänen. Четыре плитки шоколада, найденные при вас, после исследования будут вам возвращены.
Die Luft ist kühl und es dunkelt, I said.
Судя по вашим документам, ваше имя бригадир Глан. Вашли это документы? Это правда, что вы бригадир Глан?
Und ruhig fließt der Rhein, I told them.
Или не украли ли вы их? С целью изобразить из себя бригадира Гланда, может быть, финемецкий солдат, который присоединился к своему бывшему врагу, чтобы бороться против молодой российской республики.
Der Gipfel des Berges funkelt, I answered them.
Может быть, вы стараетесь одурачить нас?
Im Abend Sonnenschein, I concluded.
Your spell of captivity among the Russians was, I believe, rather a short one, General.
Yes, about 4 days, all told.
Would you care to tell us about your escape, sir?
Escape's hardly the word. I didn't exactly escape. The Ruskies, how shall I put it? They sent me back.
Why was that, sir?
No one knows to this day. They were very cunning about it. It was a very dark night, snowing as usual. There was no brutality. They were impeccably courteous. I'm afraid the salient fact is they got me dreadfully tight on vodka and locked me in a sealed transport vehicle. It was one of our own, which they'd somehow captured. They then drove it, and me, to an obscure spot on the front, which was very ragged at the time, took off the wheels, and left me there.
It must have been a great relief to your own men, sir.
Well, I have to report that my fellow countrymen didn't quite come up to scratch on this occasion. Of course, it was all explained later. But I've never quite forgiven them. They didn't approach for several hours, though they could see me dimly waving through the window. It was a converted bus, as a matter of fact, used in peacetime for the journey from Tunbridge Wells to Maidstone. All children occupying a seat must be paid for, it said inside. They explained later that they thought I was mined.
Mined, sir?
Yes, they thought I'd blow up if they came too close. I didn't, of course. And eventually they came and let me out.
Strange action on the Russian part.
Oh, I expect it was just some propaganda move on their part, you know.
I suppose you didn't manage to see the ballet after all, General?
No. No, they were on tour. In fact, the whole thing was a blithering washout all round, really.
And you've never been back to Russia?
No.
Do you ever think of going there?
No. I have vaguely toyed with the idea of dropping in on my way to see old Chou En Lai in Peking next month. But I see little real point in going to Moscow, you know. I think the Russians can be pretty well written off now, don't you? They have no bearing, I think.
No.
Well, there's no reason why others shouldn't go, of course, but after my Chinese trip, which I do feel it's my duty to make, I intend to settle back here with my pictures and my poems and my bells and whatnot, and wait till they ask me to take over the BBC. If they do, of course. If they do.
As I said, we were all of us, as members of the BBC Features Sound Interrogation Unit, greatly flattered and touched by the General's almost paternal interest in the BBC. The subject came up again at tea the next afternoon.
Look, you chaps, while Miss Moss is upstairs, I just wanted to ask you, you're not after it yourself. Either of you, I suppose.
And after what?
The job. CNC. BBC.
Oh, good heavens, no, sir.
You're sure of that?
Why, yes, sir.
I only ask because we live in a world of such bad faith these days. Bad faith, socialists, communists, dark clowns, and widespread contumely. And though I have the qualifications, I haven't the, the pull, as you might say, the influence. Mind you, I'm all for personal influence and that sort of appointment. You don't want to have chaps in places where they don't know the chaps who've got them there. I once wrote a poem on that very subject. It ran as follows. It's no good beating about the bush, and there's no doubt about it, influence tell. You must have pull, or you must have push. It's exactly the same with Bell. I've written quite a lot of poetry, actually. Oh, here's Miss Moss again.
General, you said you would let us see your picture collection today.
Hmm? Oh, why, yes, of course. Let us make our way across the courtyard. As you know, I had the gallery built specially to house the things. I'm sorry old Sister Alice is still not awake. I know she's not dead. I sent up to see. This is the collection. Rather small, of course, compared with the Tate. But my aim has been unity of theme throughout. I achieved that by seeing that all the pictures should be pictures of myself.
Many of them by yourself as well, General.
Well, naturally, you can't keep on commissioning pictures of yourself. Doesn't run to it on an army pension. So I've had to buckle down to it myself from time to time.
Oh, of course. This is the famous Augustus John.
Yes, I'm afraid it is.
Awfully like, isn't it, sir?
Think so?
Oh, yes, sir. Don't you?
No.
Oh, but it's really frightfully good, sir.
I think it's splendid, so full of character.
Yes, but dash it, it's the wrong character. Still, it's a picture, and he did say it with me, and I assure you it was far worse when it first came here.
You mean?
Yes, I've done what I could for it. Here and there, you know. The moustache is wholly my own work. Hadn't got one in those days. Let's press on.
I thought you said the pictures were all of yourself, sir.
So they are. That's one of the self-painted ones. It's myself about 4 years ago.
Yes,
I know what you're thinking. Others have thought the same. But I look like Dirk Bogard in some lights. Let's press on. This is myself many years ago with my horse, Don Carlos. Also done by myself.
That's very charming. You must be very proud of that, General.
Oh, well, it's nothing really. And here we have an experiment in spatial values, as distinct from merely tactile ones. It's a life mask of myself wearing an army respirator. Rather an experimental piece, of course. I did it myself. Almost suffocated myself before I was through with it. Still, it was in a good cause.
This curtain, sir, is there a picture under this?
Say? Oh, yes, there is, but we keep it under a curtain, you know. It's very large, and we think it's, better that way.
Is the curtain because of the sun, sir?
Well, no, it's because of the picture, actually.
Might we?
Oh, well, yes. Go on. Open it up if you want to.
I say, my word.
Good God.
It's the only full-length one. By R. Edgerton Bunningfield, A.R.A. Dreadfully realistic, isn't it? Well, I mean, apart from being 14 feet high.
There can't have been many generals who've been painted in the...
No, by golly.
Wouldn't you have preferred it, well, say, in uniform, sir?
Good heavens, man, I'd have preferred it in anything. Anything. But Mr. Bunningfield insisted on it. It ruined me. I had to buy it from him. Otherwise, he threatened to sell it to the National Portrait Gallery. People come from miles round and ask if they can take photographs of it, especially schoolboys. Now, let's cover it up, shall we?
I thought you said all the pictures were of yourself, General. Is this a fancy dress, Juan?
Which one? That? Oh, blast. No, of course it isn't. That isn't me. It's a colored photograph of my sister Alice in Quality Street. I've told her not to sneak down here and put that damn thing there. That means there's one missing. I shall give her a good talking to the minute she wakes up. Silly woman, silly woman, silly woman.
You find the arts a refuge, do you, in your retirement, General Gland?
Yes, the arts are a refuge to us all, of course. And I've often found myself in stressful moments making up poems and the like. Nothing extended, nothing modern or diffuse. Pregnant brevity, I like to aim at. And the fancy little pieces make their effect. There was, for example, a marching piece I wrote called Wrangle March. I have very agreeable recollections of discussing it with my friend Miss Hilda Tablett. She was very keen on settling it to music. And in the end, I agreed.
General, well, there's no doubt about it. It is a poem you've got here. I mean, you can see it is, you Benito. Look at it. Shut up, old
man. I'm so glad you like it, Miss Tablett. I trust you'll enjoy settling it to music for me. It shouldn't take long.
Oh, really?
I would, of course, like it to be settled appropriately.
Oh?
Yes, in due measure, you know.
And I should so like to sing it at your birthday feast, General Glenn.
Oh, thank you, Miss Strauss. That would be a high delight.
It would bring back my childhood for me. I was surrounded by militant music as a child. My grandfather was trumpet major in the regiment of Schönbrunn.
Well, I never.
And as a girl, I had a little instruction inside the trumpet myself.
Elsa!
Yes, you know, I think we ought to have a trumpet somewhere about in this piece, Miss Tablett.
Read the words to us, Hilda.
Sure. Rangoon March. There's always a certain amount of worry and fuss. And a soldier's life has many a bugle.
Excuse me, Miss Tablett. Huh? Bungle. Not bugle, bungle.
Yes, I get it. And a soldier's life has many a bungle. But why we're all such jolly good pals, if you ask us, is you can't bungle in a jungle.
Forgive me one moment, Miss Tablett. A point of sketch. Now, the end of line 3 is, if you ask us. Us, you see, rhymes with fuss. A bit higher up.
Oh, yes, I get it.
And bungle rhymes with jungle.
Yes, I did gather that, almost at once.
Oh, really? Splendid.
Well, it's a splendid piece, General.
Oh, well, thank you, Miss Tablett. I did think myself it had, a sort of a lilt, you know, a sort of a little lilt, I thought.
I'm sure it must have.
I would like the settling of it to have a certain jungular atmosphere about it, as well as the trumpet, if possible.
Well, anything's possible, General. Any other instructions?
Well, it's a purely personal feeling, and I've no wish to dictate things outside my province. But do you know a little number called Habanera from Carmen?
I have heard tell of it.
A beautiful piece. If you could manage to wedge a bar or so of that in some way, it would bring back, well, for me at any rate, the most pleasant memories of my afternoons in the jungle with my dear friends, Sister Martin and the two nurses.
You seem to have been living it up in that old jungle of yours, General.
And though I have no wish to influence you in any way, Miss Tablett, I wonder if you've ever heard of a splendidly expressive instrument by the name of a tubular bell. It's never been sufficiently exploited, to my mind.
The only thing is, General, the poem, remarkable as it is and it stands, is a bit short.
Oh.
Any chance of you knocking me out another verse in the same meter, say?
Well, I'm ever yours to command, Miss Tablett. But, you know, inspiration doesn't come just for the asking. And pregnant brevity has never been my aim in these effusions.
And Miss Tablett, set the poem?
Yes, you might say she settled it. But my goodness, I sweated blood knocking that second verse out. Oh, blood, by golly. Still, it got done in the end. I remember it as though it were yesterday.
I have so much enjoyed rehearsing it. I have relived my childhood.
Oh, I am glad of that, Miss Strauss. It's nice. A nice childhood is.
Ready, boys?
Yes, ready.
Got your dots?
All set.
Okay, let's ride it.
Mentioned the jungle, General Grant.
Ah.
When were you there, General?
Oh, all through the Second War, you know. And before. And after. Yes, by golly.
And how did you happen to be sent there, General?
Oh, I was already out in the Far East in 1939 when the Second War was declared open. I was out there doing a tour of duty.
What at, General?
Ah, Miss Moss again. I was lecturing to the men, you know. Lecturing to the men.
On what subject, General?
Oh, that I'm afraid I am not allowed to reveal.
And had you other duties, General?
Oh, well, damn it, it's 20 years ago, after all. I suppose by now there could be no harm in saying I'd been sent out there to set up links.
Between what, General?
Ah, now, ha-ha. That would be going a bit too far, ha-ha. Yeah, let's just say that I was setting up links, shall we?
Did they ever break, General?
Oh, they were known to, occasionally. But, of course, it wouldn't be in order for me to say where.
No.
And it had no bearing. But, as I say, I was out there when they turned on the wireless and we all heard old Joe Chamberlain announcing that since 11 o'clock that morning, this country had been at war with Germany. Personally, I saw at once what the implications were. I turned to poor old Bimbo Morgan, who was standing next to me at the bar. Bimbo, I said, this means war. Think so, he said. Believe you me, I said. Have another, he said. Right, I said. I downed it, and as I've always believed in keeping everyone in the picture, I then went out and told me Batman. Well, Reed, I said, we shall be back in Blighty before we know where we are. Yes, sir, he said.
That, in fact, wasn't the case, was it, sir?
No. And perhaps it was as well that it wasn't. For it was the outbreak of war, and my presence doing secret work out there, that finally got me where I now am in my military career. 3 days after the outbreak of war, a signal came through. I need hardly say what my feelings and emotions were when I read it. You can imagine.
What did it say, sir?
I'll tell you. It said, stop where you are, stop. This is an order, stop. We will raise you to Major General if you promise not to come back, stop. Or Belisha, stop.
I suppose the European war didn't impinge on you out there for some time, General.
Why, good heavens, man, the supplies of French's acting edition stopped dead the minute war started. Dislocated things terribly. It was part of my scheme to stir up amateur theatricals wherever I could find a suitable breeding ground for them.
But excuse me, General, what did you actually do about the war in the Far East?
Miss Moss, I like you very much, personally. Always have. But I sometimes wonder if you know your own strength. Just as many of my colleagues out there didn't know their own weakness. Like you, they got off completely on the wrong foot. Now, let me try to explain the position I started out from there. Have you ever heard, Miss Moss, of the Gahai Pygmies of Southeast Papalen?
Yes.
Oh, have you? Well, very few other people have, I can tell you that. These remote people were my starting point. Now, the position was quite clear to me. I could see at once that if we were going to win the war, and what was no less important, anything in the nature of peace, say, that might crop up later, then every single jungle tribe would have to be kept in the picture the whole time. They had to understand what was going on. We had to win the sympathies. Bribery, of course, was out of the question. I hadn't reached that point of cultural development. Are you following me, Miss Moss?
Completely, General.
Oh, well, no matter. There they were. The Gahai Pygmies of Southeast Papaland. A charming, simple, extremely virile race. Though dreadfully small, of course, like all pygmies. Barely touched by civilization. Their only garb, a small loincloth, loosely slung over the right shoulder. I have said that they were charming and simple. If I tell you that their chief occupation was making very artistic little mats for sitting on, and that any European who did sit on one of these little mats invariably came out in a painful rash that might last anything up to 4 months, you will realize that they were a very gay and playful little race also. I liked them. But let's face it, pygmies are far too small to be of much use in the actual field of warfare. For one thing, you have to keep lifting them up the whole time so that they can see better. The important thing I saw at once, and I was quite right, was to find out exactly what these little people could do and try to persuade them not to do it to you. They were lively and intelligent little blighters, and as I say, they did make these dreadfully interesting little mats. I did bring one down to show you. Now, where's it got to, I wonder? Yes, Miss Moss is sitting on it.
No?
No, don't get up, Miss Moss. And I felt that they had to be kept in the picture, you see. And so we used to have regular gatherings in the jungle where I would explain in the simplest possible way what was going on in this picture I felt they ought to be kept in. May I have your attention? You chaps now, quietly please. Quietly, everybody. Thank you. Now, I know you all know that the nips have got to be knocked for six. But some of you may be wondering what the whole thundering kerfuffle is all fundamentally about. And it's precisely that small thing that I'm here to put you in the picture as to. Yes, quite, dear. I shall try to do it without an excessive amount of bull, because bull, I think we all agree, is on the way out these days. Oh, really? Yes, I agree. The whole thing's a bit of a headache. And some of you may point out that it's a bit of a shambles into the bargain.
Hey, go-go. Bulangwa Bahuli. Bahuti.
Well, the situation being of necessity a fluid one. Hey, no, don't touch that, old boy. No, no, no. The situation being of necessity. No, dead bell and white man's juju. The situation being of necessity. Sir? The situation being of necessity of. Reed, put that blasted bell on your head so they can't reach up to it. Dad Bell Badgeroo! I want to make it clear that we've still got to knock the nips for six. Yes, by golly.
By golly?
By golly?
Tahuti, tahuti, by golly.
Kai bole?
By golly.
Kai bole?
By golly.
Tahuti, by golly.
I call it.
What I was saying was, the situation being of necessity a fluid one, changing from day to day. I want to sew the whole thing up. But Reed, I said put it on your head. I'm pretty sure. But once I've given you the drill, you'll be able to see what makes the whole thing tick. You just have to realize that though we may be out on a limb, we're all, as it were, on the same limb. Now take the case of those supply people some of you tried to eat. And so, gradually, one got it across to them. I realized and they realized there was a war to be won. This seemed to me a policy that must be pursued if we were to win it. And did we win? I think it may be said we did. But I don't think we should have won it without the enthusiasm we managed to build up among these gay, simple little corpuscles in the great bloodstream of Southeast Asia Command. Sometimes in the evening of my life I visit the meetings of the local conservative youth club. There's no comparison, none at all. Everybody so overdressed, so tall, so dreadfully big.
Arthur Gland.
Excuse me, I think someone wants to speak to you, General Gland.
Arthur Gland? Arthur Dowd, Hyacinth Dowd, Wilbraham Court Gland?
Good gracious me, it's my sister Alice. She's got up.
Arthur Gland, why are you awake?
Well, damn it, I might as well ask why you're awake. It isn't your usual state. And button your nightdress up. And what have you put that damn silly picture of yourself in my gallery for? I won't have it there.
The sin of pride speaks through you there, Arthur Gland.
No, it doesn't, Alice Gland. I won't have it there.
It's a very good likeness. You ought to be pleased to have it there. Who are all these dreadful people? What are they doing in my house?
Please don't address my visitors in that way, Alice Gland. They have a perfect right to be here. They came down to sound the ground.
Sound what ground? If any ground round here needs sounding, I can sound it myself, by golly. It's perfectly sound. It was sound even this ain't the well.
They've come down to sound the ground to see whether I'd like to be Controller General of the BBC.
You can't control yourself, let alone control anybody else.
The sin of envy speaks through you there, Alice.
No, it doesn't, Arthur Gland. I don't want to be Controller General of the BBC.
Nobody's asked you to.
Yes, they have. Why aren't you asleep?
Why should I be asleep? I'm entertaining three distinguished visitors. And if you'll only stop talking for a minute...
I shan't stop talking. It's my house, by golly. I shall talk as much as I like.
I might be able to introduce them.
I don't want to be introduced to anybody. Everybody knows who I am, and it's my house.
Well, it oughtn't to be your house if you can't keep awakening. It ought to be my house.
The sin of covetousness speaks through you there, Arthur Gland.
No, it doesn't, Alice Gland. I don't want the house. But it's a pity if I can't have a few old friends in now and again who wish to know about my career.
You haven't had a career.
Which has been far more distinguished than anybody else's in this family.
Pride speaks to you there again, Arthur Gland. That's twice today.
No, it isn't. I'll now introduce my guests to you.
I don't want to meet them. They oughtn't be here without me being warned about them.
If you didn't spend the best part of your time in a cataleptic trance, you'd have been warned about them 3 days ago.
The sin of anger speaks through you there, Arthur Gland.
No, it doesn't. This is Mr. Bill Lovell of the BBC British Investigation Bureau Sound.
There's no such thing.
Yes, there is. And they're all in it together, very companionable. This is Mr. George Hicks. If he can stop talking for a couple of seconds, you'll hear him demonstrate a speech peculiarity quite as remarkable as some of your own.
There's nothing remarkable about the way I speak. My voice is as clear as a bell.
Bill! It's blasphemy to make the comparison!
Anger speaks through you there again, Arthur Gland. That's twice for anger today.
No, it isn't. This is little Miss Moss, a very fine young woman of great charm and persistence.
The sin of lechery spoke through you there, Arthur Gland.
No, it didn't, Alice Gland. And it's jolly well 4 o'clock and we jolly well want our tea.
The sin of gluttony spoke through you there, Arthur Gland.
It didn't. It was plain, starving, craving hunger. An appetite very rarely satisfied in this house. If it was my house, people would be free to eat the whole time.
People seem to be eating the whole time as it is. I never eat. It'd be a poor lookout for me if I ever tried to while you're in the house.
May I introduce my sister, Alice Gland?
I have no intention of standing here exchanging idle courtesies of people who've never even been invited here. You can have my tea sent up to me on a tray, and I'm going back to bed.
The sin of sloth speaks through you there, Alice Gland.
No, it doesn't.
Yes,
my
it does.
Sleep
of
is creative sleep. I know perfectly well what I'm
a
doing.
Of your age,
I'm far more active when I'm asleep than you are awake.
Fast asleep.
By
golly. And if you
have to wait, you can't find me, you have to turn it around, it doesn't interfere with other people, by God.
That was my twin sister Alice Dowd Jonquil Dowd Corkland.
Yes. Thank you, sir.
Dear old thing. She's invented a new religion called creative sleep. Keeps her quiet. I'm dreadfully fond of her. We've always got on.
Yes.
Sorry you can't meet my other sister, Connie.
Yes, sir. So we.
Yes. Oh, you get reconciled to these afflictions as you get older, you know.
And you feel you can look back on the past with no regrets, General?
Oh, rather. Ha ha. Yes. And on the future, too, uncertain though it is. Ha ha.
What do you mean, General?
Well, it'll be a bitter day for me if I end my days without becoming Controller General of the BBC. I don't want it to become an obsession, naturally.
These things can do, of course.
Oh, yes. The late Thomas Hardy once told me of a man who actually pined away and died because he desperately wanted to become public hangman.
Oh, really?
Yes, there was only ever one of those at one time, either.
Hmm.
Still, I don't think we must press the comparison too far. Do you think?
I don't think so. No, General.
No. Well, that cuts out rather a lot of what I wanted to say, but no matter. Just let me read out my concluding remarks, then. I hope they'll do. I think the great days of generalship are probably over. Wars there will always be, of course. They are part of man's nature. But I sometimes feel that some of my brother officers, with their wistful hopes that they may find openings in what are oft times referred to as small wars, or cold wars, or limited wars, are barking up a chimera. True, none of us want these massive, overgrown, cosmopolitan wars. God forbid, they'd be grossly exaggerated, whichever way you look at them. No, what is really needed is not a cold war, not a small war, not a limited war, but a civil war. And by that I mean a civil war that goes on long enough for people to get used to it, and in a very real sense, fond of it. A ding-dong affair, in short. And such a war, homely as it may seem, does nevertheless test something the larger scale shows never bring into use. I refer to the intellectual grasp of a general. A civil war really does put that intellectual grasp to the test. For in a civil war, a general must know, and I'm afraid it's a thing rather of instinct than practice, he must know exactly when to move over to the other side. Yes, my golly. Well, there it is. I conclude with the words of a great poet, not himself a general, but a fine writer and a whole man. The tumult and the kings depart, the shoutings and the captains stay, and shall not pass if in our heart tomorrow be another day. Here we are where we ought to be, and we lay about with our will. Home is the sailor, home from sea, and the miller, home from the mill.